In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Matthew McGrory, CEO of Arbon AI.
Well, I thought this is great. We'll create some technology, it'll fix the problem and everyone will buy it. So I was wrong on that part. I got to about demo number 200 and it was with a US broadcast news organization. And the guy there, the head of digital, said, listen, I'm protected by the First Amendment. I can let anything go up on my channels and I don't have to get rid of it. You're giving me an extra job to do, an extra cost. Tell me why this is valuable to my business. Tell me how it makes me money or saves me money.
This is Matthew. He's a tech entrepreneur on a big mission. He has held tech leadership roles in various companies. He was the IT director at Logicalis, Director of Managed Services at Acora, and Managing Director at Carenza, a cloud service provider that was later on acquired by Six Degrees Group. In the period from July 2018 to September 2020, he took a break from his corporate life and became a house husband. In that period, he developed a passion for using AI to drive positive change. That led him to co-found Arbon AI in September 2020. Arbon AI is a platform that helps its customers actively moderate and manage their community across both paid and organic socials. Their mission? To make social media a more positive place by filtering out hate speech and toxicity. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Matthew to my podcast. We explore what's broken in today's social media world. Matthew shares his vision to make social a place without toxicity and spam. He then elaborates on his hard-won lessons from his journey to speed up direct sales and benefit from using ecosystems to grow even faster. Last but not least, he shares his framework to increase resilience across the organization. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how he gained traction in a market where customers resisted to buy because they saw their solution as an extra job and an extra cost. Secondly, what he did differently to gain technical and commercial momentum. Thirdly, what he invested in early on to get access to strategic accounts and speed up the commercial contracting process in enterprise sales situations. And fourthly, how he goes about keeping the business humming and keeping everybody aligned and motivated, especially in tough times. Well, hi, Matthew. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your company, Arbon AI. But before we start, a little bit about you. Yeah. What drives you? What did you get energy from as an entrepreneur?
Well, it's a good question. What gives me energy? I like to make stuff happen. I can't stand. I'm the right side of it, the impatient line to be an entrepreneur. I think it's one of those things you have to be eternally impatient and you want to get up each day and it's going to be a brand new day. You're going to fix some new problems. I don't normally quote people, but I loved a little, it was a little video of an Elon Musk interview. And he said, it's like running a business, like chewing glass. Every day you're getting up, you're chewing glass. It's hard work. It's grind because, and the way he framed it was that you end up with all the problems no one else in your business wants to deal with. They all land on your plate. There's no hiding from it. And I love that. I love getting up. And sometimes it can be good fun because it's a fun problem to fix. Sometimes it can be horrible because it's, I don't know, it's some accounts you need to fix or something like that. And it's a bit more taxing. So yeah, business side, that's what drives me. I can't stand being bored. I can't stand mundane. We've kind of got drive, move forward. I come from an IT background as a CIO. And I remember doing ITIL, the kind of the framework. It was started in the UK government on how to run your IT business. And I loved the concept of the continuous service improvement plan. And soon as you fix it, you start again and reevaluate and re-improve. So that's what drives me. I've driven towards, you know, we've got a goal at Arwen to kind of do something that we think's like interesting and important and cleaning up social media. So that's also, yeah, it's fun. Yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah, that's a good bridge, I would say. I love how you say that. I've never heard that quote about a chewing glass. But it's what you were saying about making stuff happen, the impatience to make an impact. That I mean, when I saw what your company is doing, removing the bad, tackling the negative, and amplifying the positive when it comes to social, I was okay, this has to be on my podcast because this is a mission that I think we are all going to benefit from. So when you started your business in September 2020, illustrate what drove you to say, okay, now it's enough. Let's fix this.
Well, there's a couple of things happened actually. So I had exited another business, a cloud business, a couple of years prior, and I'd promised my wife that I would be a stay-at-home dad while she trained to be a teacher. And so I had to sit on my hands, but I had a great time with my now 9-year-old, was 3 and 4 at the time. So most of the mums in my local town know me really well because I did all the play groups around town. But I went off, and after about 18 months of doing that and really dedicating myself to that, I then became a non-exec director for a couple of AI businesses. And it was very clear I was doing kind of helping them with go to market. They were very technology focused business, and like they wanted to know how to position their products in the market, and they didn't really understand the sales process and how that happens. So I helped them with that, and it taught me over that year up to the start of the pandemic in sort of February, March 2020. This AI has got legs. That's probably what I would say. You know, it was clear that this thing is going to start taking over the world. In the same as we'd all talked about big data for the decade before, exactly. Was kind of the drive up to AI. I actually had a go at coding and realized I was 20 years out of practice. The last time I'd coded was back in the 90s, so that wasn't going to work. So I teamed up with my CTO, who was a family friend of my wife, a guy I'd known for quite a long time. And we sat in a room and said, I've got 3 or 4 ideas that were stuff we can do with AI. I'd like it to be fun and interesting and game changing. I don't want it to be boring. So we kicked a few ideas around. One was around care homes. So using AI to review patients, things like Alzheimer patients, how much they move and all this kind of stuff. Because there are a lot of cases where people end up, like in that case, their sleep is disturbed every 2 hours because they have to be checked on. So you can use AI and motion monitors to do that. So we did a little bit of work there. We did a work on 2 or 3 other ideas, but we realized very quickly that the total addressable market for social media rubbish removal, which is my sort of literal elevator pitch when someone asks me in the elevator, which is our kind of moderation product, is enormous. You know, everyone's using social media. The world, the hate stuff was getting worse and worse. My own particular issue was during the pandemic, trying to stop my teenager, who was 13 at the sign, kind of go off on all sorts of tangents of social media. It became a bit of a mission for me to find an app that cleaned it up for him. Now, whilst we haven't gone into the child's market, we're more adult focused. It kind of came home to roost during the last Euros that were on. So I don't know if you remember, but in the final, England, three black English players missed penalties. And the racial abuse they got was just kind of off the scale. And my son showed me his phone. He supports Arsenal. So he followed Bukayo Saka, the Arsenal player. And he showed me the feed on his phone that Monday morning after the final. And I was just like, he's 13. He's being exposed to this. This is like, we need to make a success of this business and push. And yeah, and we're good. We're making waves in sport now across.
That's what I saw, yeah.
Yeah. So good.
Because, it's an enormous problem. And I mean, I don't think it's only sport. There's spam going on everywhere. And toxicity is going on also pretty much everywhere, also in business. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I've seen those. Well, these situations, you can just, the moment something like that happens, you can just see it explode on the internet because it's so easy. Yeah. So yeah, that inspired me to get you on the podcast because I think it's an enormous problem that that needs to be removed. And
one of the things that journey, that first 18 months, one of the things that struck me is I thought it was going to be easy, right? I thought it was going to be easy. I start a business, we'll fix this problem. I've done all the research. Everyone's been saying, I found articles going back to 2008 of people complaining of toxic content going on forums and channels and moderation required. So I thought, this is great. We'll create some technology. It'll fix the problem and everyone will buy it. So I was wrong on that part. So
really? Okay.
I was wrong. And I must have done net today probably 600 or 700 demos, but I got to about demo number 200 and it was with a US broadcast news organization. And the guy there, the head of digital, said, listen, I'm protected by the First Amendment. I can let anything go up on my channels and I don't have to get rid of it. You're giving me an extra job to do, an extra cost. Tell me why this is valuable to my business. Tell me how it makes me money or saves me money. I said, well, okay, but you accept it's actually the right thing to do. He said, I get that, but we're a team of three. You're giving me a whole new job to do. Show me that doing that job, A, is not only the right thing to do, but makes me more money. So we built the tech, we fixed the problem, we find out we need to show that the problem isn't just a moral or ethical situation that needs fixing. It's a financial imperative. It costs you money. So and that's what we did for the last, I say up to 6 months ago, we were very focused on, if you get rid of toxic content, you improve engagement on social media, you make a happier place to be. And I did a talk. There's an organization called United Against Online Abuse, UAOA. It got started by the FIA, the governing body of motorsport. And we had an event in Paris about a month ago, and I did a keynote talk. And I talk about, everyone's talking about how horrible this is. And I said, that's great, but Elon isn't going to listen to how horrible it is. He's going to listen to how much money does it make him. So we need to start framing this problem that Arwen's trying to address in how much money it costs brands, having not unbrand safe advice. How much of your audience switches off? And in particular, what we found with all the research is that women, if you're a brand and you are focused on women, which all sports brands are, you are inviting women into your sport and they are consuming a violent and toxic social media space and they switch off and they disappear and they'll go somewhere else. So it's about protecting your asset, protecting all the money you spend on marketing to bring people in. When you get them there, you need to provide a safe place for people to enjoy the sport. You know, so that's I have an ongoing discussion stroke argument with my son, who's now 17, about, I say women's football will be bigger than men's football in 20 years' time. He goes, rubbish. I tell you, I say it's a better product. If you think about where all the money's spent in the household, mum, my wife will take children to women's football game. She wouldn't take someone to a men's football game. So we're quite close to Chelsea's women's team where I live. So we sometimes, I've been to a few games there, and no one, there's not one swear word. No one argues with the referee. I come from rugby. We don't argue with referees in rugby. But you go to a men's football game and you have a whole different environment atmosphere. Yeah, lots of passion, all that sort of stuff. But I said, that women's football product is going to be more valuable. You know, look at the growth rate of it. Anyway, we'll see who's right in 20 years' time.
Exactly. And I think it's going to be earlier, by the way.
Yeah.
Completely right. Well, I mean, that was exactly my next question. So what is the opportunity if you get this right? And I think it's interesting for everybody that's listening to this podcast to reflect on it. Just by having something that everybody agrees with doesn't make it something that people will buy. Everybody wants to get, believe, yeah, okay, it's good to get rid of. But the moment it is, there's a cost related to that, or like you say, people see it as an extra job. They have to defend the value, then you have to come up with other arguments. So I got some questions on that later on. First, now, you started in 2020. That's where the idea came up and you started building. Where you are right now, also kind of knowing what you know right now, what has been an early decision that you took, maybe technology-wise or maybe go-to-market-wise, that appears to be super important for what you see as the success right now?
I mean, there's probably a couple of technology bits which were just like the back-end boring stuff, but we quickly just... I said to my CTO, and I had been a CTO and a CIO in a past life, I said, we just need to make quick decisions on the tech. We can't have big beauty parades on which database do we use. Let's do a selection of 10 and spend 3 months. I said, you just make a quick decision, go with your gut. What's going to work for the next 6 months? Because in 6 months, we can change it. And then 6 months after that, we'll change it. And it was quite a difficult mindset to get the rest of the team onto. I said, look, in a year, you're not going to have an engineering team of one. There'll be three of you. That's the plan, right? So there'll be three times as many people to fix problems. And then a year after that, there'll be five people. And then a year after that, who knows? There'll be 10 or 20 or whatever. So you have to think about problems in like right now, how do I fix this problem? How do I move forward? And don't think about to fix this problem in 6 months with just me. That's going to be impossible, but that's fine because in 6 months, it won't just be you. You'll have a buddy, maybe another buddy. So
let me make a small interruption here. Matthew just made a critical remark. That's the secret to what makes them resourceful. Do what is right for today to solve for today's problem. And don't overthink what will not happen in the next 6 months. Momentum is critical in today's market. And that starts by being practical. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They realize that they cannot please everyone. This helps them to focus on the essence and solve for that. And that allows them to create momentum and learn fast. That's noticed. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So one of the early things we did was like we picked AWS. We basically went for completely serverless. So everything was kind of as modern as we can make it. So we were kind of as bleeding edge as we could. Because we knew that, you know, the way I look at other tech businesses, you sometimes look at their tech stack, even when they're 5 years old and their tech is 7 years old because they chose technology when they started a year in that was already 3 years old. So they're now kind of getting there and they're 7 years old. They've got big technical debt and all that kind of stuff. So I just said, look, don't be afraid and we'll just change as we go along. But CTOs, they worry about technical debt a lot. And I'm just like, no, it's fine. It becomes such the percentage impact as you grow just becomes smaller and smaller. So that was an early tech decision that we took quite quickly to just
drop. It goes with your mindset, you know, what do you get energy from? Make stuff happen, and the impatience possibly as well. But yeah, it's really like, yeah, make a decision. Good is good enough. Move on.
Yeah. I've also seen a lot of, because, yeah, you network in this world. Yeah, one of the places we go to SASTA every year, the kind of SAS event. They just had it in London this year.
Exactly.
Been to the last three. But so you kind of meet up with people. And one thing I find it always amazing is, I was a techie and I went into a sales background for 10 years before I started Arwen. And the number of people that want to build something before they've road tested it and sold it. Yeah, I call it, print out the bit of paper, the marketing sheet, and go to either if you've got some customers, go to them. If you've got some prospects, ring them up and say, I'm thinking of building this thing. Would you buy it? And they'll say yes, no, or only if it does this, or if it does this, it might be useful.
Yeah.
That whole kind of that prototype process, people get fixated on, I need some money to build a prototype, to build an MVP. Well, you don't need any money to type an idea around, put a few pictures on, make it look pretty. CEO of a SaaS company I met said, we did that and we did some advertising. So we advertised it and we saw if people clicked on the advert. That was, and we were trying to work out what was the thing that people were going to be interested in to buy. And all it was they did an advert, people clicked on it, and then they went on a waiting list. So they were put on a waiting list. So he could work out advert number four created the biggest waiting list. So that's the feature, that's the thing that people are going to find the most value in. So very often that type of thing, and it's obviously much less expensive than building a thing and then giving it to people and they go, no, this isn't what we wanted. Yeah.
I said, well, I mean, completely agree. It's and also your story around, you don't have to build a full-fledged product. Just start testing things out. Where are people going to buy it?
Yeah.
Even better, of course, when you actually get them to say, okay, I'll actually vote with my wallet, pay for it.
Yeah.
And that's the best part. But that's how you move forward.
We're sort of quite proud on the demos now. We say to people, other than our initial prototype, like every single feature in Arwen is all ideas that have come from clients. They're all customer-led. If we sit there and go, oh, I wonder if this would be good, it normally isn't. It's normally a bad idea because we came up with it. You listen to customers, they come up with ideas. Our product that we've got, we launched it about 6 months ago, Engage, which is how we amplify the good stuff. It came from Red Bull. Red Bull race team, Formula One racing team. We went to see them last summer in their mid-season break, and they talked about it'd be really good if we could kind of find the good bits of data from our social media. We get so much. We're so busy on a race weekend. How do we find those golden nuggets that we want to respond to, or we want to amplify, or we want to do a press release around or engage people in? So really listen to your clients if you have them.
Exactly. Yeah, that is that three-lever step that you were talking about, right? Remove the bad, tackle the negative, and then amplify the positive, and that's where your engaged product comes in.
Correct.
So talking about those, you start moving, you make those fast decisions, knowing that you can always change your mind. What has been the hardest nut to crack right now? Have you possibly ever got stuck? And if so, what did you do to fix that?
I got stuck many times. generally, it is trying to hold back because the world moves slower than you do necessarily as an entrepreneur. So, and by that, I mean, you put things in place and you have to, it's like, you plant the seed in the ground. You just have to be patient and watch it grow a little bit before you kind of, move it on too quickly. And I think my biggest reflection on the mistakes I've made has been, I've always pushed a little bit too hard at times, when I probably just should have sat back and gone, no, everything's fine. Stay still. Don't hire another person. Don't spend that money. Just stop and just keep doing more of what you're doing and you'll be fine. So kind of some of the downs and ups and downs and ups in my journey have been because I've tried to push when it's been too early. And now I'm just coming up to 4 years in. And now I'm like, fourth time I've done this, I've gone, no, we're not hiring anyone. We're just going to say things are going well. We're winning clients. We're just going to solidify around that and kind of solidify what we're doing and just keep doing it and growing the company. And so that's what I would say.
Have you got an anecdote around this or an example?
I've got anecdotes my fundraising journey has been, we're only had angel investors. So we've raised £2 million from angel investors only. We haven't had any institutional funding, and that's all coming in chunks. So at certain periods, we suddenly go, oh, we've got, you know, £400,000 in the bank account. Great, whoopee-doo. What's our sales and marketing strategy going to be for the next 6 months? Because we need to make Arwen famous. So suddenly we go out, we spend it on this event, this event, this event. We go and kind of get out there, and we haven't got the case studies in the bag yet. We haven't, you know, we haven't got all the bits in line that mean that event is going to be really good for us. So you end up doing an event, wasting an event. You kind of make excuses to go, oh, it was all right. But in reality, it was awful. It didn't go as planned at all. And you were expecting it to go much better. So I would definitely say on the sales and marketing front, I had a period where I hired a kind of whole sales and marketing team, about five people. And you don't expect all salespeople to work out, so that's fine. So we kind of had a bit of turmoil in that period. And part of the challenge, having run a business before, when you run a business of 30 or 40 people, letting someone go isn't a big deal. It affects a few people around them. It doesn't affect the culture of the business. But in a startup, if there's only nine of you, and you have to let two people go, it's a very significant cultural shift in the business. And it's a much bigger impact than it is at bigger companies. So you have to be, you know, the old phrase is really slow to hire, quick to fire. I agree with that. Whereas sometimes I've been quick to hire and slow. No, I'm not normally slow to fire where it's not working out, but just not making those painful decisions really, really quickly. I would say it's on the sales and marketing, you know, just building that sales and marketing effort. I was also listening a lot to, I've got a cap table that has 25 investors on it. So lots of opinions. They're all telling me, no, you need to sell, but hire salespeople, go, go, go. I had an instinct that it wasn't right, but I sort of listened to other people rather than kind of reflecting that back.
Yeah.
And just thinking about it a bit more. So I think sometimes no action is the right course. Yeah.
Yeah, good point. Absolutely. And specifically also because there are all these opinions, just take them for what they're worth and then make your own decision. Have you got a framework for making those decisions? Or is it just the principle, okay, I'll wait for 24 hours to think about it, sleep about it?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, definitely the sleep about it is a really good plan. I mean, I'm very much, I live with my P&L and my cash flow forecast. Like, I update it like three times a week, right? And I'm much to the annoyance of my accountants and finance people, because they're like, can't you do this once a month? No, you can't do it once a month, because I make decisions five times a week and I want to see what impact those decisions would make on the business and what would happen if we win this deal, don't win this deal. So for me, it's having that numbers framework of and making sure you put that impact in of what's going to happen. And I love, back in the day, it's quite an old book now, but Good to Great is one of my sort of must read books. And one of the chapters in there, in that book, is confront the brutal facts. And I'm always saying to myself, you've just got to confront the brutal facts. You didn't win that client. So Don't carry on pretending that they're going to walk through the door. You've lost them. Move on. Let's go on to the next thing. This guy isn't a good sales guy for your business. Yeah, he was great at his last business and he smashed it. He's come to a startup, doesn't work. You've just got to confront the brutal facts, have a conversation with them and move on. So I think for me, the numbers never lie. That's why VC firms love them. The numbers never lie. Trend is your friend, all that kind of stuff. And you just got to look at them. It was great, actually. We have we're all remote apart from once a quarter we meet up. And then once a year we do two nights away, the whole company, in lieu of having an office. So we went to the Peak District, which is kind of in the middle of England, Derbyshire. It's kind of where the Industrial Revolution began in England. So lots of old mills from the Victorian period and 17th century. And we were sat there having this thing, and we did, the management team put up on the board a lovely graph that showed everything going up. And one of our engineers said, "I don't mean to be difficult, but you showed us this graph last time with everything going up like a hockey stick in that direction. But they didn't quite go that way this quarter, did it?" And we went, "Yeah, but look, you can see it started." He said, "Yeah, I get it started. I believe that it started, but it's not quite going up like you thought." So, yeah, very often having that kind of real truthful input is you've got to really question yourself on that.
Exactly. And then, yeah, especially also when you create a culture whereby everybody can actually speak up and call you out.
Yeah.
It is important because, I mean, I've seen those hockey sticks as well. And it's always a hockey stick. It's never going to fail. Well, talking about kind of going to market then, I'm not sure how many customers you have at the moment, but I saw your website and they have some very impressive logos there. You already mentioned Red Bull there. What has been your biggest challenge to overcome when it comes to getting traction? And you already kind of highlighted the disbelief of companies that said, you know, yeah, I see that we should fix this, but why me? Why do you give me an extra job?
I think that the number one issue is distribution channel. So getting your product, and I mean sales distribution, so getting your name and product into as many places as you can get it. And if it's only, you know, in my business, it's me, I've got one inside sales guy, I've now got a partner sales guy, and there's a marketing guy attached to us. So there's four of us trying to tell the world about Arwen. That's not many people. So what we have found quite useful, that's the biggest challenge, I think. And what we have found really useful is, and it is talked about a lot in SaaS circles as a strategy, is that partnership effect. How can you partner with other businesses? So we've had a really, I used to work at Fulham Football Club and I used to work at Brown's Hatch as an IT manager in the past. It was my favorite job ever at Fulham Football Club, but I had to leave to forge my career. Otherwise, I'd just still be there now. Really fun working with professional athletes. But so one of the difficulties of talking to sports organizations is, how do you get Lewis Hamilton on the phone? You know, how do you get George Russell on the phone? We've just signed up some Olympians ahead of the Olympics. How do you speak to these people? Almost impossible. They've got agents, they've got managers, they work for organizations. Just not going to happen. So we forged a really good partnership with an organization called Sport Radar. They've already got 350 customers in the sports arena, and it's proved an amazing route to market for us. We've got a couple of other partnerships in the legal sector where people provide kind of brand reputation type services. And again, you're talking to one person who has access to maybe 100 or 300 or 1,000. Yeah. And I would say we probably didn't get to that as quickly as we should have done. We are, for the last year, we've been very focused on partners. We've just been doing a round of introductions into outsourcers, so the BPO, the big BPOs, who do content moderation and social media management for big brands, because the chances of us getting hold of the chief marketing officer of Unilever, who I saw in Cannes, I went to Cannes Lions a few weeks ago, and saw her speak, The chances of me getting her on the phone are very, very small. But the chances of me getting through to her through one of her partners is actually, that's a much higher probability of doing that. So we've kind of gone for a 80-20. We're still going direct to market. We're still going after our core sectors. But for some of them, we've said, right, sport, we're going all the way through these two partners. For broadcasting, we're going to go direct. That's a direct market. For these types of brands, we're going to go through these types of partners. So I think we could have done that a good year earlier than we could. So does that answer?
In hindsight.
Yeah, in hindsight. Yeah.
Hindsight is always, of course, yeah.
The books did tell us to do that. We just ignored the books. You know, it was in, we had five bits of advice saying, it doesn't seem right to me. And what I meant was, that's quite hard. So let's put that on the hard pile and we'll come back to it in a year. When actually starting that really early, because some of the partnerships took 6-12 months to kind of mature and get to a good working relationship.
Fascinating that you say it's hard. And I've had numerous conversations on this podcast about, you know, doing the hard things first pays off so much. And here's an example of why you should have done that in the first place. What is intriguing to me that you sort of mix how you go to market and you decide for one vertical is partners and for another vertical is direct. What's behind that?
It's basically down to we've done a lot of soul searching around the personas that we target. And what we found was the user of our product is typically the social media manager, an operational person. They sometimes have the budget, but often they don't have the budget. But the VP of marketing or the CMO normally has the budget. They're slightly less incentivized to talk to you because you're not the biggest, most important thing on their agenda, but you're really important for the social media manager. So it's sort of a two-pronged attack. For some people, I can probably connect with someone on LinkedIn who's a social media manager, and I can probably have a chat with them and get them on a demo. That's not too difficult to do. But to try and get the VP of marketing on a call is probably quite challenging and difficult to do. So there are kind of different approaches to different personas in the marketplace that might want to be a user of our product. So that was part of the reason in that we could see that social media managers at, you know, high street retail brands in the UK, actually not that difficult to go after individually. But the people with the budgets were three people higher, and they were dealing with a publicist or Saatchi & Saatchi advertising agency. And so we were going, we need to talk to these eight partners to kind of get in at this level. So it was very much persona driven more than sector driven. Although in sports, it was very much, so that was a sector driven. Having worked for a football club, you know, I know how difficult it is to talk to football clubs, and they're not run like businesses. They're run by the personality of the owner. I mean, I worked under Mohammed Al-Fayed, and so the whole of Harrods and Fulham, which he owned at the time, and Fulham Football Club had a slight bit of Mohammed Al-Fayed's personality. And when you would go to other sort of network with other IT managers and directors at other Premier League football clubs in the UK or in Europe, you could see how, you know, the culture of the owner kind of brought down into the club. So, yeah, very open entrepreneurial people would have very open organizations, but it's very difficult to find the person with the budget because everyone has all sorts of weird job titles, because it's a sports organization. So partnering in that sector, really, really useful for us.
Yeah. Okay. There's more gray areas there, and if therefore...
You know, so we've just done a partnership with Match.com, with Hinge, the dating app, and it was really easy to get a hold of them. You know, they got a group structure, they got a house of brands, they got a clear job structure, everyone's got specific roles, so you know who to talk to. You know how to pitch your product. This is the paid ads manager. So they're really interested in improving their paid ads. This is the organic social media manager. So this is what they're interested in. So you can kind of tailor the demo to the persona.
Fascinating. But yeah, good to understand. I mean, it's the persona at the end, of course, like it's the person that has the power to buy. Is it also that you've chosen those verticals maybe because of the fact that the problem that you solve is more valuable to them and more critical to them?
Without a doubt, we've definitely gone after, we talked about, what's our ideal customer profile, the ICP, so the companies that want to buy our product. And it would be, there are sectors that put high value on social media. They're probably typically more B2C. So we would categorize as we're a B2B2C kind of sale. I mean, there are some B2B contexts, but really it's a B2C context. And ideally for us, our perfect customer for us is a house of brands, So I talked about Unilever. Yeah, they'd be a dream for us because they got hundreds of brands that they need protecting, or Procter & Gamble, or, some of the big car conglomerates. Yeah, they're our real targets because you get into one buyer, if they see the value, they can stretch that out. But yeah, definitely certain sectors, consumer-driven sectors, and sectors that have woken up to social media and realize that, having a conversation with your clients is quite important. I know in the real world, if you own a store, people get that, but it's like the number. I mean, I saw a survey recently, only 7% of enterprise brands use social media in its social context to talk to their clients. Most are obsessed with content. What content should I put out? Put out the content. And they let this whole kind of storm occur on their brand account against these posts. And they just kind of let it happen. They don't get into the conversation. Sure. They don't answer questions that their customers are asking them. So it's changing, but it's slow. Hopefully we're helping it go a little bit quicker. But that's where we're really, really excited. We've got a few consumer brands now that they're going, we're using AI to automate the suggested response that their agents can give. So how do I answer a question? We're using an AI technique that marries large language models with the client's data sets. So their own frequently asked questions and things like that. So we can answer the question using AI, but it will be to the specific client's detail. So when does the shop open in the morning? Right, we've got in our database, we've got all the opening times, so we can say 9 a.m. or 8 a.m. or whatever it is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's fascinating that sometimes you respond, and it's also, I sometimes also connect to a brand and you leave a comment and you never get anything back. Yeah. So it's, of course, they likely don't even follow it. It's indeed obsessed with pushing rather than converging. Yeah. Just before our call, you mentioned that you, of course, came from the cloud industry, more the back office type things.
Yeah.
The unsexy nature of those type of businesses, and that you now, of course, are in a radically different area, having brands like Red Bull. What difference has that made for you in the whole go-to-market scene?
It's great in the sense that, I remember when we signed Mercedes Formula One was our first full-paying enterprise client. So the great first client. We had some clients who are having the product for free, we're testing it, things like that for us. But Mercedes Formula One was our full client. And I remember I was doing a mini investment raise, and I went out to all the investors and said, we've just signed Mercedes Formula One. They all said yes instantly. So I'm in. If Mercedes wants to buy, and I didn't think, not that our investors are bad people, but I didn't think people were that kind of easy to persuade based on a case study, but I was wrong. It's like, and I think
it depends.
It does depend. And I think the ability to get some really recognizable brands in your customer portfolio and talk about them, and even if you can't talk about, stick them on the website, you need to push them out in your demo. So it's not maybe the client doesn't authorize you to share it around, but you need to say, these are our clients. And especially in the US market, there's just no point in talking about anything other than US brands in the US market. So we're now up to about, I think we're in double digits now, so just over 10 clients in the US. So Match.com group has been fantastic because it's Tinder, Hinge, Match.com, OkCupid. Yeah, way before my time. I've never used any of the apps, but my wife was fairly suspicious of me having all these dating apps on my phone. I obviously said it's market research. But yeah, I think having those brands, it just gives the person you're demoing to that feeling of, yeah, okay, I get it. Someone else has done it in my market. I know who they are. I can see how this would work for me. Really, really helpful in that go-to-market. And yeah, I just think it's how quickly you get to that point is so important. How quickly, and even if you give it away, you know, we gave it away. Our first sort of 5-10 clients, they got it knocked down price or they got it for free. They obviously helped us with feedback and things like that.
Yeah, sure.
They told us what was wrong. But and asking some of them for, can we have a case study? Can we do a video testimonial? Those sorts of things. Hugely important to win your next 10 full paid up clients. So I would say, yeah, massive, massive impact on the go-to-market. Yeah, I always find it amazing when you say to people, yeah, we've got ATP or a client, we cover tennis, we cover Formula One, we cover Premier League football, we cover ice hockey, you know, and then you sort of say, no, we're not a one-trick pony. We've got, you know, 20 clients, all big organizations. I came from an enterprise background, so as in I used to sell to enterprise businesses. So things like ISO 27001, which we got back in February, we started working on that over a year ago, and I just knew it was going to be important because, you know, Match.com, I remember her coming back to me and saying, that's the quickest information security questionnaire we've ever had completed. We did it in about 10 days. She said it normally takes 6 weeks. So we just kind of had all the answers ready. It helped that I came from that background. So we had a leg up. But just things like that, depending on your sector, depending on your product, if you're selling to enterprise, you're going to get an information security questionnaire. You're going to have to be a bit open-minded on the legals. So we've softened our legals so that we don't end up with this big red line that goes on for ages. So that's really helped reduce the kind of part of the sales process. So client says yes, how quickly can we invoice them is dependent on those bits of the process, not...
Exactly, exactly. Because in the beginning, you know, like you say, either certification or all the other regulation parts are not important unless the customer is already sold on what that they want to have you. The rest is just, you know, it's knockout criteria. And that's, yeah, for a small startup, these are the hard things to get through. But congratulations for making that that happen. I was looking at the time. You know, I wrote my book, The Remarkable Effect, and that's about the 10 traits that define the software company you start talking about, keep talking about. What do you push for in your company so that you become a company that people start talking about and keep talking about? I mean, you already talked about partners. Of course, what you do with the product, what product problem you solve is possibly like enormous well of stories that you can tell about. But how do you go about it?
It is difficult because it's difficult to know what to say. But I try, for me personally, it's about being a little bit authentic and just making sure both internally and externally, you're picking the stories that you personally feel passionate about. And I'd say that to all my salespeople I get on board. I said, listen, I've told you my story and I tell you you hear all the stories about all the clients and all the little nuances about we did this for Hinge and we did this for Lewis Hamilton and we did this for Mercedes. I said, what you've got to do is find the exciting story that sounds authentic when you talk about it to someone in a demo, because they will feel that you're a bit passionate about how you transformed for this client. And I talk about Hinge a lot because we didn't ask them for a case study. And then my CMO sent me a quote from Elke, the lady we deal with there. And I read it. I said, oh, I don't like that quote. I think we need to change it. And he said, no, no, no. That was on their website. They put that there themselves. yeah, there. And I was like, oh, okay, right. Well, I better not change it because it's her quote. You know how normally you sort of, I want that to be slightly different. So being, having that authenticity, I think, is kind of really important. And I sort of drive that in the business. I'm a very, I think I'm a bit more transparent than I read most CEOs are. I sort of think if you're trying to get people to join your startup, you can't really be secret. You have to say, everyone's asked me, you know, what are the timelines? I say, well, in reality, who knows? But the plan is this, you know, and I'm honest about the plan. And I was honest. I remember 3 years ago, I got my sort of foundation team together and I said, like, I know this is going to be a little bit democratic, but the reality is I'm going to make all the decisions. So if you don't like me or you don't like the way I make decisions, then kind of you've really got to think hard whether you want to work for this company because we're a startup. There's only like nine of us in the room at this point. So you're not going to last 3 years, 4 years, 6 years if you do the whole journey working with me. If you don't like me, it's just not going to work. So it's bonkers to think I'm really excited about this, but I don't really like Matt, so I don't want to work for him. So I'm very open, and I think my whole working life, I've always sort of thought, you know, you've got to bring a little bit of light, you've got to bring a little bit of personality, your home life, into the business,
Definitely.
wherever you can, wherever you can. So I'm a, I think I talked at the start, I'm a musician. So lo and behold, at our last away day, we had karaoke. Yeah, everyone got up and sang a song. So it's like, you know, and I encourage everyone else, you know, what are you passionate about? What do you want to do? Go and do it. I also, we've also really got the opportunity to work charitably as well. So we're working with a charity called No More, which is a charity about removing, basically addressing violence against women and girls. So they deal with domestic abuse, and that's both in the home, so physical, but also online. So we're helping them with a project that we're getting funding off the UK government for. And it's just like, it's love. I mean, we're doing it. We have to charge them something, but we're charging them at cost. But it's great to be doing something that you feel, okay, I enjoy getting out of bed because I'm doing something that's nice and charitable and worthwhile. We're still making money. We all still want to get paid at the end of the day. But it's like, yeah, much nicer to be working in a business that can do those sorts of things.
I completely agree. I had the CEO of Ticket Taylor on my podcast as well last year, and he told a similar story. And a lot of times people think, okay, it's a purpose-driven business, or well, having a purpose as a business doesn't work together, you know? And for them, because they didn't start with a purpose, they added a purpose later on,
Yeah.
and it worked fantastically because it just glued everything together. All the numbers are up. All the metrics are up, and they're just it turned out really, really well. Last question. Based on your experience in various roles and various companies, and particularly, of course, the last 4 years as CEO, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share based on what you know right now?
Well, that's a difficult question. What would be a do? Well, my do is probably do. So I see so many people procrastinating over whether they should make a decision. So, and I say all the time in my business, I'd say, like, crack on, do it, make it happen, do it. In 30 days, if you're wrong, we will know that you made a right, it was the wrong decision, or we could just do nothing for 30 days and we will have learned nothing, right? So I literally, I say it to the techies all the time. They're sort of apprehensive bunch. Yeah, do it. Just whatever it is that you're deciding to do, do it. I remember there was, I think it was a CEO coach I went to see at some conference, and he said, you, as a CEO, you should be making five decisions a day. And I reflected on it over the years. I thought, well, what about everyone else? Why does the CEO just make five decisions a day? We should all make five decisions a day. And it could be small, tiny decisions. This isn't like, you know, I'm going to hire this person or I'm going to fire that person or do whatever. it can just be little decisions you make. But I find the procrastination is a real enemy, like stopping making decisions. So I don't know if it fits in the do or the don't. It probably fits a little bit into both. Don't, I think in a startup, I would say don't do what I do, which is kind of run off. You know, in my first 2 years, I was firing the starting gun all the time. Right, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. I think you need to be a bit reflective, and I think you need to really focus. Don't think that you can do 55 different things. You know, you can do one, maybe two. So do that one, do those two, cut all the other stuff out, do them really, really well, and then add a second, and then add a third. So don't go too wide too quickly. You plenty of time for that later on.
Yeah, completely agree. And the funny thing is, like, it's almost counterintuitive what you're saying, because you say, okay, don't procrastinate, go, go, go.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a boundary there, or some guardrails. Well, thank you very much for sharing the story, Matthew. Where can people go to find out more about Arwin AI or to say hi to you?
Yeah, so we've got a website, www.arwen.ai, arwen.ai. And I'm on LinkedIn, so Matthew McGrory, MATTHEW, surnamed MCGRORY. Look me up on there. I'd love to hear from you. I think my email address is on there, my phone number's on there. So give us a call.
Okay. I'll make sure that that's part of the show notes. But thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you.
And this ends my conversation with Matthew. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Matthew McGrory, CEO of Arwin AI. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.